It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, Chris Abram, one of Canada's most celebrated directors of theater and film. He's currently artistic director at Crow's Theater. Chris is a graduate of the National Theater School's directing program, and he went on to serve as co-director of that world-renowned program. Hang around, because Chris and I talk about some of his directorial choices over the years at the Stratford Festival, and his work on the play Seeds, a courtroom drama that documents a Saskatchewan farmer's legal battle with Monsanto. And, you know, when you talk about genetically modified food and the relationship between our government, big business, and farmers, well, you know, that's going to be good. So, thanks for listening. Settle in. In case you're new to the podcast, The Inadequate Life, my aim here is to publish a new podcast once every 2 weeks. And you can find all the episodes and some other really interesting information and artwork on the website, theinadequatelife.com. There's also a spot there where you can, if you so choose, leave a donation, a small donation, anything, it's really up to you. Or if you want to leave a bigger donation, I've got some stickers for you and some delicious tea. And that is courtesy Karen Hartwick, the owner of StratfordTeaLeaves.com. She supports the show, supports the show in the form of a sponsorship. And I couldn't do the show without her. And, you know, she's really cool. She's one of a few certified tea sommeliers in Canada. So if you're like me and you enjoy tea as much as I do, go online and visit StratfordTeaLeaves.com or visit the shop in Stratford next time you're there and tell her how much you appreciate her support of The Inadequate Life. And, you know, when I started doing this podcast, I really had no idea if anyone would be interested or who would listen. And thankfully, Karen helped out and expressed her interest. But I did get this email the other day that I was so excited to get, I got to say. And you can also leave an email for me at theinadequatelife.com. It's an email from a former student of mine back in the United Arab Emirates. My wife and I lived in Abu Dhabi for a few years, and that's where I taught journalism and filmmaking. And I got to say, it was one of the most exciting and interesting times in my life, sharing the power of storytelling through film and through journalism to this amazingly enthusiastic and culturally diverse audience. It was just one of the best times of my life. And Cole, our little guy, he spent his first year there in Abu Dhabi. Anyway, here's the letter, a big surprise from a former student. I won't mention her name, though, because, you know, out of privacy. Anyway, Keith, I didn't realize that you were friends with Chris Patterson from the musical comedy group The Arrogant Worms. It's the same band that does the Happy Birthday song that Power Hit Radio, the station at the American University of Sharjah, would play when someone requested it. And The Arrogant Worms did Carrot Juice's Murder, the song that my boyfriend frequently references. This was a great episode to listen to. We miss you here at AUS. Thanks. Oh, it was so nice to get that. That was just a great letter. I miss the kids and my colleagues back in Sharjah, just outside Dubai. If you've got a message, send it to me. Or if you want me to interview someone in the Canadian cultural community, just let me know. I actually met Chris initially online through Twitter. He is one of, I'd say, the best directors or artistic directors using social media right now, and Crow's Theater do a great job with that. And in the interview, we talk about his most recent production at the Stratford Festival, Shakespeare's Othello, and how Chris brought out the themes of faith and doubt. Faith and doubt. And talking about that with Chris and seeing his production reminded me about the time in my life before I met my wife, Susie. That was a time when I was in a relationship, or, you know, several relationships, that really just weren't working out. They were going nowhere. And I remember complaining to a friend about the fact that I knew in my heart, I knew that this relationship I was in wasn't going anywhere. But I also recognized how important a long-term relationship was for me. So I was having this paradoxical frustration. And my friend, who some of you might know as the mighty Aphrodite, thankfully, she said to me, she just simple words, "Don't you have faith?" And she questioned my belief in faith and true love. And she really basically made me feel like an empty vessel, you know, which was not very fun. And then she drew out the question, "In your life, Keith, what do you have faith in?" And that was a big question for me at that time, and I wasn't ready for it. But thinking about it, it did make me realize how important faith is in a relationship. And that relationship I was in ended. And faith and doubt also play a role in the show Chris is working on right now, Seeds, because that show raises the issue of our faith in science and the judicial process, you know, some of the pillars of our society. And as I talk to creative people on this podcast about their creative process, I realize how important faith is to that process. Not only to have faith in your ability, and you obviously have that, otherwise you wouldn't be creative, but you have to have faith in whatever it is you're working on. That goes without saying also. But what I've really come to realize is how important it is to have a support network that can be there for you when our faith fades. You know, and you get into those times when it just doesn't make sense and you can't figure things out. Now, there's no doubt that Chris came from a supportive family. His parents weren't into theater at all, but nevertheless, Chris started acting at the age of 12. And later on, when he was in university and decided to drop out of university to pursue a career in theater, his parents were there to support him. And I got to tell you, like, his parents were teachers. It must be horrible because, you know, academia, it seems like a natural flow for a teacher. And then you just, I'm not going to go to university. I'm going to pursue theater. Tough moment in anyone's life. And it was great to see that his parents were there for him when he went through that process. Chris and I met at the Canadian Stage in Toronto, so thanks to them for giving me the space. Chris is going to be directing a show there, Winners and Losers. The play looks at the ruthless logic of modern-day capitalism through two friends who agree to disagree. We talk about a couple of things in the podcast. Chris introduces me to the genre of verbatim theater or documentary theater, which I think you're going to really find interesting. And as much as it was cool and fun to talk about drama and theater, I really enjoyed talking to Chris about bringing up kids. We both have 7-year-olds. And I don't know about Chris, but I know that I occasionally feel doubt about my own ability to bring up a child. Fortunately, I have faith that family and friends are always there to help out. Faith and doubt. Here's the interview with Chris Abram. So here we are at Canadian Stage in Toronto, which I think is kind of interesting because many years ago, 95, you directed A Midsummer Night's Dream here.
I was actually the assistant director.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. No, so the assistant director. Yeah. And you're going to be doing that play at Stratford, the 2014.
That's correct.
So have you done it since 1995 as an AD?
No. That was it. And I did, it was actually for the Dream in Hyde Park, and I assisted for the two productions. In the old days, they used to run every summer production for 2 years.
Gotcha. So now you're going off to Montreal again to do, what are you doing at Centaur Seeds?
It's a play called Seeds, which is a play that we did a couple of years ago at Crow's in partnership with a company called Porte-Parole Theatre in Montreal. And the play is about it's actually a documentary play or verbatim theater. There's a couple of different ways to talk about the genre, but essentially it's a play composed of interviews with real people that have been then turned into text for actors. And the story of the play is about a legal battle that took place between a Saskatchewan farmer, Percy Schmeiser, and Monsanto over their claim that he stole their genetically modified canola seed. And it's a legal battle that took place over a number of years that made its way to the Supreme Court, which ended up in a decision against Percy Schmeiser.
Yeah, nobody sues Monsanto. Didn't he know that? Like, that's the conventional. I don't know anything about the play, but the conventional wisdom is you can't get away with suing Monsanto.
Yes, I mean, there were it was a complex decision at the Supreme Court, but essentially it upheld the right of Monsanto to hold a patent on a seed, which is sort of the core of the big question. Who owns life?
Yeah, which is really tragic, especially in this country. Like, I mean, we're aware, at least I'm partly aware of the how Monsanto was working in the United States. And I think a lot of people don't realize that it's happening here in Canada.
Yes.
And, you know, a buddy of mine, Lorne Elliott, who hosted a CBC radio show for years and he does stand-up comedy, he said this to me because he's traveled everywhere in Canada. He said, the people in Toronto forget that you can go to the top of the tallest building in any city and see agricultural land in this country.
Yes.
And it really makes you think.
It does.
You know?
Yeah.
And then this kind of stuff still goes on here.
Yeah.
It's just horrible for the farmers. And horrible for us, horrible for life.
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny being in southwestern Ontario in Stratford for the summer is that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, farmers have done very well with genetically modified seeds, which have patents on them. And so there is, you know, there's why I think it's, you know, a pivotal narrative and why we're doing it and why the show's going on tour, Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, and Ottawa this year, yeah, is because it remains one of the most important areas for us to pay attention to in terms of public debate. There's still a lot that we don't know about genetically modified foods, genetically modified seeds, and a lot of big questions about the legal and ethical framework in which we're, you know, this technology has proliferated in Canada.
Without, my understanding, without any long-term testing on its impact on our well-being.
It's true.
So anyway, I'm kind of, you know, and one thing talking about social network, the tweet that I've put up in the couple of years that I've been tweeting that got the most retweets, and I was surprised, but I shouldn't be, was about the problem with the bees and all the bees dying because of everything, the neonicotinoids and all that sort of stuff. And I was so thankful that people take this issue very, very seriously.
That was certainly our experience doing the show, was realizing that there was an audience with an appetite for these kind of pivotal narratives, that is, stories that are of public concern, mm-hmm, that touch their lives. They feel a little bit lost in the midst of the left and the right.
Yeah.
And certainly the ambition of that show was to try to bring the polarities of perspectives on GMOs to the table and give the audience an opportunity to really sort of survey the evidence as best as we could present it in about 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how do you bring that to the people, though? I just asked that because one of the challenges, certainly, of going to a place like Stratford,
sure,
and a lot of conventional theaters, is the price. It's Young People's Theater a couple years ago brought their ticket prices right down here in Toronto, and apparently it did really well for them, and it brought theater to the people. And the Seed sounds like a show that would be great if it was accessible.
Yeah, we work very hard to keep ticket prices low. Yeah. And for example, in our new theater in the East End, we sort of have a model that allows us to keep our tickets, the average price, under $20.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, no, I think it's a big thing, especially if you want to nurture a new audience. You need to remove impediments to people's first step into the theater.
Yeah,
you need to make it easier for them to take a risk on something. Yeah.
And you have time to talk a little bit about the concept, the genre of verbatim theater,
sure,
which I'm not familiar with. So it's taking texts that exist and then repurposing them on stage.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, I guess in its most general sense, verbatim theater can be, you know, you get text either from interviews or found sources, or, you know, it could be the telephone book. But the principle is taking something that exists as a text, as a found source, and translating it or transforming it into a piece of theater. It's a form that I've been interested in for about 5 or 6 years, and my first sort of real experience working on it was with Seeds, with this company Port Burwell, whose mandate is to do exclusively this kind of work. And
so is it Port Burwell?
Port Parole.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I gotcha.
P-A-R-O-L-E. A witness, you know, to be a witness to something. They've basically been working in this form for about 10 years. Annabelle, who is the artistic director of the company and the writer of Seeds, and actually a new project that we're working on together about the future of fresh water in the country, basically spends years interviewing individuals on, you know, have different points of view around a situation of conflict. In the case of Seeds, it was this legal battle, accumulates a long list of transcripts, and then begins the process of writing is about actually assembling transcripts and looking for patterns and trying to understand what the inherent story is within the conflict, and through a series of drafts and then workshops, making a play out of it.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
And I think, I hope as a genre it takes off, just because it's another thing to get us thinking about important things. But I mean, in my life, I'm watching more documentaries now than ever before.
Yes.
In part just because of the online distribution, whether it's Netflix, or you're just or the documentary filmmaker puts it up. And you know, a great example is Louis C.K., who made his film and charged people $5 for it. $5 or whatever it was. You can't say no, you know. It was just a brilliant thing he did. So I love the form of sort of exactly what you're talking about. It's real and here we go. Although, you know, with documentary films, it was my film teacher at Carleton, and I love this line. I use it when I talk to my students. He says, what's the difference between a documentary film? The main difference between a documentary film And a feature narrative film is in the documentary film, The Characters Don't Get Paid. Which I loved.
Yeah.
No, and as a director, you can appreciate it. How do you feel about taking other people's words and then, again, repurposing them for your purposes? Have you had any negative backlash from anybody that's been featured?
No, but in fact, that question is, you know, kind of forms one of the thematic strands of Seeds. And what is it to take life and modify it?
And that's brilliant, yeah.
So, you know, that becomes one of the big ethical dilemmas for the character of the playwright that's at the center of the story. And I think anytime you're working with other people's words who are a piece of who they are, there are a different set of questions that you have to ask yourself about what you're doing with it.
Absolutely, with other people's yeah. words. Yeah. Well, that's so exciting. So that's it. Centaur in Montreal. What has it? How long does it run till?
It runs, I think, until the end of November.
Okay. And then Calgary?
Calgary in the new year, Vancouver in the new year, and then the spring in Ottawa on the main stage. And it stars a great, you know, one of my favorite Canadian actors, Eric Peterson, plays Percy Schmeiser, who's... It's a great role for him. Yeah.
Now, your success at Stratford has just been amazing with, you know, obviously The Little Years, The Matchmaker, Othello most recently, and the only one I haven't seen is For the Pleasure of Our Company. I didn't see that one. I'm sorry. So do you feel a lot of pressure on, you know, doing a show that J. Kelly Nestor, when I interviewed him on the podcast, he actually said the words, "I don't need to see another Midsummer Night's Dream." Those were his exact words. Mm-hmm.
I don't so much feel pressure as I, you know, like external pressure. I'd like to, you know, I feel the pressure of wanting to create a production which allows the audience to sort of see the play anew and see what's beautiful about it and enduring about it and see it in a new way.
That's a hell of a challenge, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's sort of the challenge with every, you know, every classic text that you look at.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you kind of want to go to the heart of it and discover what it's trying to say, and then also understand what kind of resonance that it has for you personally, and that what resonance it might have for a public, and kind of bring those three focuses together.
And at Stratford, in 2014, there's going to be a small chamber version with four actors, directed by Peter Sellers. Now, are you going to be in touch with him at all to sort of talk about your different versions, or?
Probably, although, yeah, not initially. I mean, I think I'd have a general sense of what his adaptation is looking at, and have read little bits about what he's said about his relationship to the play, and that's sort of enough for now. But yeah, no, I'm very curious. I hope we get to chat.
It'll be fun. I mean, as an audience member this year, I went to see Taking Shakespeare, the play about a young boy who's suffering and is in an English lit class, and he's supposed to be studying Shakespeare and he's not doing it, so he ends up going to see the dean's a teacher on the he's the dean's son. He goes to see a teacher who teaches at the university to help him understand what he's doing. They study the play Othello. So I actually saw that before I saw your version of Othello, and it made for a much richer experience for me, for sure.
I agree. I mean, I read the play I think an earlier draft of the play a year before we went into rehearsals, and I wasn't sure initially how I would feel about the context that the play would provide, but I found it very moving, and I got a lot out of the play when I read it, and even more when I saw it before.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
No, I'm really glad that the audience had that experience, that double barrel experience, whether they saw Taking Shakespeare before or after seeing Othello.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea that Anthony Cimolino is doing. And again, so it'll be much more cohesive, I would think, with the two versions of Midsummer Night's Dream in next year. Hey, so we'll talk a bit more about the stuff you did at the Stratford Festival and stuff you're doing going forward. But let's talk a bit about your background. Now, I don't know anything about you. I looked a little bit online. Although I have to say, in terms of online, one of the reasons that we were here is because you're just an amazing user of social media online. And has that been a conscious thing you've tried to do? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, primarily in terms of my company, which we're undergoing a big growth spurt right now. So certainly, you know, every mechanism that you have,
that's
particularly the ones that don't cost any money, you take advantage of. As a theater practitioner and someone that's a producer running a company.
Absolutely. So that's part of the reason. So you are super active on Twitter, and it's how we hooked up, I think, initially on Twitter.
Yeah. No, we saw we've seen actually really tangible outcomes from having a paying attention to what goes on Twitter in terms of the shows that we produce.
Oh yeah, and it, as you said, it's free. And it, you know, I did a in February in my social media class. I had my students rank the top ten Toronto theaters based on their clout score.
Yes,
I think you guys were in the top five or six anyway.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it always varies, of course, depending on what's happening.
Yes,
in the
exactly.
season.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you find the time to do that? Because other people I've talked to say, I just don't have the time.
You know, you squeeze it in. Yeah, and I've been a little less. You know, this past summer, I've been maybe a little less active than I've been at other times. I think, you know, you just make time when you feel that it is, you know, you're trying to get the word out about a show or...
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, the thing that you do is it doesn't feel like you're trying to do that. You are building authentic relationships.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love that you did on social media, on Facebook, you're going to be in Montreal directing a play there at the Centaur, and you said, I need a babysitter. Anyone have any? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
See, that's exactly what social media is for.
Yeah.
I don't think you've put anything on Facebook about your upcoming show.
Yeah.
But you made it clear. Oh, I wonder what he's doing in Montreal. And then people are just gonna. Did you get a babysitter, by the way?
We did. Yeah.
Through the Facebook post?
Yeah. No, it works really well because I'm friends with a lot of younger actors, so. I think young actors make the best babysitters in the world.
That is so, yeah. And Facebook's a great place to find them. Anyway, so kudos to you for sort of setting an example to other folks in the business who might be hesitant about social media and are pushing, like you said, oh, I've got a show, I have to push.
Yeah.
Just talk about it. And it took me, like I teach the stuff, and it took me a long time to understand the value of writing a tweet like, I always buy kale with the best intentions, but it always goes in the garbage. Because I think that's a universal thing, right?
I had kale last night. I just actually said to my wife that kale is my favorite green.
Well, it's a great...
I like it raw. I like it cooked.
I'm coming around to it, but I buy it more than I can prepare it. And I was kind of freaked out when a farmer told me, she says, you know... Kale absorbs more pesticides than any other leafy green. I know
that.
Exactly, because the leaves are so broad. Sorry. Anyway, so I buy it, and I usually cook it. And then another farmer, because I go to these markets out where I live in southwestern Ontario, another farmer told me to, if you're frying it up or something, put the kale in the fridge or the freezer for about 10 minutes before you cook it, and it sweetens it up.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's very good information. But I guess now it's... Probably I'm going to be looking for organic kale versus...
Yeah, which you can, you know, if you get near Whole Foods, you sort of get that.
Exactly.
But I still eat it. I got discouraged. But those personal tweets, which initially you think, oh, they're so banal, or, oh, God, I need a babysitter. What am I going to do? Put it on Facebook. And you're drawing people into the fold. And then, you know, the shows that they go see, you're going to be that much more meaningful.
Yeah.
Knowing that you have your family in Montreal and you're struggling just to have a regular life. How many kids have you got, by the way?
I've got two.
Wow, how old?
16 months.
Oh my gosh, I've got a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
Is it a 7-year-old boy or a girl?
Girl.
Okay, I've got a boy, 7. And have you taken her to much theater?
Yeah, she loves, she spent the last couple of years, big chunks of it anyways, at Stratford and has seen, I think she saw Fiddler on the Roof 5 times.
Oh man.
And she pretty much sees everything in the season. She saw Othello, she closed her eyes at the last scene, but we've always taken her to the theater.
And do you think because of what you do, the magic, and I think of Fiddler on the Roof or even Othello, when we saw, we took Cole to see Peter Pan and we had good seats, but you could actually see the wires supporting Peter Pan. So I didn't say anything to the guy, and he never said anything, and I thought, oh, that's great. He figures Peter Pan's and the kids are floating around, but then 3 weeks later, we're just standing outside and he says, oh, Daddy, you know, I could see the wires on Peter. And I'm like, oh, the magic's gone. So do you feel your daughter is already past that because she knows about the process that you're so involved in?
Yeah, I think she does. I think she's willing to suspend her disbelief to increase her pleasure of watching something. But she's also begun to look at something, to look at her play experiences more analytically. She's kind of indicated that she'd like to be a theater designer. So she's keen to look at you know, how design is working in a show. And we have a close friend who she knows who's Julie Fox,
who did the beautiful work with Othello.
So I think
that's one of the seven things she'd like to do in her life.
But here's the thing that I can't figure. I think that's great, but I always figure that with the kids, are the path they're on now, 7, 8, 9, 10, by the time they're 16, everything just goes to a 360. And it's like, so she'll end up being an accountant.
I hope so.
It's hard, right? Like, with kids. So what was your background? How did you get exposed to theater?
Well, I got exposed to theater and community theater initially as a teenager. I was born in Montreal and on the South Shore in St. Bruno.
Sure.
And then when we moved to Markham in Unionville, when I was 12, I got involved in taking acting classes for kids. And then there was a theater company in Unionville called the Unionville Theater Company. And I acted in a few plays. And then I had an opportunity. I was asked to be part of a junior board of directors for the theater company.
That's just having that. That's a really good experience.
Yeah.
Young people into arts administration. That's very smart.
And that led to me, I don't know exactly what the mechanism was, but I ended up directing a play when I was 14. And I kind of knew right away that that's what I wanted to do. And then I started a theater company in Markham called the Markham Youth Theater, which was the mandate was to produce shows that would be kind of acted, directed by, administrated by people under 25. Hmm. And that was how many years ago? Over 20 years ago. And it's still run.
That's
I mean,
great.
Nobody knows who I am anymore because
that's funny.
It gets handed over.
Of course. Well,
So that's kind of how that happened. And then, you know, I went to university for a year and then ended up going to the National Theatre School in Montreal.
So when you went into university, was it a theatre program or just a general arts?
Yeah.
And then what made you decide to leave that and go to NTS?
Well, it was a program that I had my eyes on.
And
I applied in the first year and got in. So,
you
know, I knew that I wanted to study to be a director. And I felt that, you know, weighing that against... 4 years at U of T, I took advantage of the opportunity when it presented itself.
Yeah. So you did the directing program at NTS?
I did, yeah.
A two-year program?
It's a two-year program.
And I want to go back though. So did your family, were they into theater? They must've been a little bit, or what did your folks do?
They were teachers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They weren't theater people, and we didn't really go to the theater as a family. My theater going experiences were largely through school trips.
Huh.
And then eventually as I became more interested in theater myself, I made it downtown to see, you know, what I could
in Montreal or
in Toronto.
In Toronto, because it was Unionville
at
Markham at that point. Yeah. And then how did your folks look teaching? I've switched over to teaching, and my wife's always been a teacher all her life. And that's such a straight ahead, okay, I know my paycheck is going to be for the rest of my life kind of job. Mm. How did your folks react when you, and you're, oh, you're in university. That's great. You know, that's a good path. And then you say, I'm leaving it. I'm going to go to, how did they react to that?
They were always supportive. I mean, it was clear, like I knew very young what I wanted to do and I was very.
You weren't going to let them get in your way.
I made that clear. And so they kind of got out of the way and, no, they were very supportive. They knew that that was what I wanted to dedicate my life to.
Wow.
And so they always were.
So helpful. You came in really. And did you ever have any civilian jobs while you did that in Montreal to sort of pay the rent? Or were you okay?
I did lots. You know, when I graduated from theater school, I probably did 10 years of Joe jobs while I was kind of making my way. And you know, I made a point of trying to get jobs in the industry. So I worked as a publicity assistant.
Right,
I worked front of house, bars, in theaters across town and sort of.
So that totally serves you now in your role as the artistic director of Crows and building this huge thing.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, let's talk about the first playbills that I saw, The Little
Sure.
Years, which debuted at Pass Me an Eye in 95. You directed it in Stratford 2011. 2012 in Tarragon won a number of Dora Awards. You actually were nominated against yourself for another play you did. And it was also the first time you worked with Bethany Gillard, is that true?
Yes.
Who you later cast as Desdemona in Othello. What, and John Mighton's play, for folks who haven't seen it, I wasn't familiar with John Mighton, but having a six-year-old kid, I was familiar with math problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mighton is a PhD mathematician, so we learned more about him. I find his script, it made complete sense to me. When I read about this guy, he's a PhD, he's a mathematician, his script is like this super, super tightly wound, and there's... very precise. There's no wasted words, you know, and it's a beautiful journey of a young girl at a time when a young, brilliant mind wasn't sort of appreciated, I suppose. So let's talk a bit about Crow's Theater. You're the artistic director there.
Yeah.
And I mean, when we were talking about the comedy, I said I was going to bring it up. So here, I want to read the artistic mandate just because folks who aren't familiar with the theater outside of Toronto. The artistic mandate is we seed projects and collaborations with artists and companies that are engaged in the examination of our culture's pivotal narratives in ways that are direct yet complex, entertaining and challenging. A process that happily and constantly leads us to recover, or reconsider, reimagine and redefine the possibilities of the theater and the world that we make. So, and
Sheesh.
It's good though. You got it pretty much all covered there. But the thing that's fascinating to me is, have you done any comedies there? I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing this out there. Because it sounds very serious.
Well, we're doing a comedy this November called Winners and Losers. And I think, yes, we've done I, Claudia on tour, which I would say is a comedy. And but no, our works tend to be... works that are going to kind of challenge you as much as they're going to make you feel something.
Yeah, it's not my question wasn't a comment on Crow's Theater specifically, but it's just more. And I think because comedies, you know, partly because of the rise of stand-up comedy, I think comedy as a genre is getting a bit more respect than it's had in the past. And I'm just wondering if that's going to translate down to theater at some point as well. Comedies do challenge.
Of course they do.
Conventional
wisdom. Sometimes they do it better than anything else.
Because you're relaxed. You know? And that was one of the things that The Matchmaker was such a perfect production for our time after 2008 and all the financial difficulties that were going on. It shed light in there. So I hope you guys do more comedy. or at least find someone to help seed some comedy. You know?
For sure.
And, you know, in terms of film and television, all our great comedic writers and performers end up always... having to go to stateside, so it would be so nice to see more of that. So you took over the role as artistic director in 2007, is that correct?
Yeah.
And are you going to be the artistic director when the new facility, when is the new facility coming up?
So we're planning to open the facility in July 2015 for the Pan Am Games.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, I'll be there.
Yeah. And I talked to another artistic director, and I asked him, much as I talked to you about your jobs you had when you were young, and I used the term, non-theater jobs, and he said, a large part of my role as artistic director is non-theater because I'm trying to raise money, I'm looking at construction plans, has nothing to do with...
It's true.
How do you balance that?
You try to. I mean, there's especially in the middle of a capital campaign, it's close to a $10 million project, so there's a lot of money to raise, there's a lot of people to speak to, there's construction drawings and a lot of relationships. So you just, I live a busy life. There are a lot of people that live busy lives, and you just try to find a balance between the creative work that you need to do and the administrative work that you need to do.
And it's amazing. It's almost like a renaissance in Toronto anyway, with all the theater activity that's going on. It seems like there's a lot more growth. What do you have in terms of a big picture in this region, do you attribute that to anything at all? Is there... Where's that coming from? Is the audience growing, or are theaters now having to face more because they're sort of cannibalizing each other's audiences?
I think it's probably a combination of both, actually. I think the audience has become, on one hand, both, or there is a segment of the audience that is more a vagabond audience, that are theater lovers that go to theater to theater by subscriptions, one place one year, another place another year. And then there are there's another audience, maybe we call it an emerging audience, that's maybe a little bit younger and like to stay a little bit closer to their neighborhoods, whether that be the West End or we're planning in the East End of the city.
Yeah.
But I think Torontonians in general are pretty mobile. I think we go to where the show that sounds interesting, that appeals to us. I think we're willing to travel, take the subway. But in terms of the growth of new theater spaces in the city, I think probably part of the reason is a certain generation of artists and artistic leaders coming of age and seeing opportunity in some of the emerging neighborhoods in the city and trying to build cultural infrastructure there.
Yeah,
I think that's true with the theater center, and it's certainly true for us in terms of
the east end of the city.
Okay. And let's talk about your next, so good luck with everything.
Thank you.
How are you doing in the $10 million department?
I'm good. We're trucking along.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's so exciting for Toronto. And part of the reason I asked about that question, well, after I studied theater, I sort of went into the Fringe Festival circuit for a while. And that for me was an amazing place. And I think the growth of the Fringe across Canada is going to have an impact in traditional theater. I think so.
I agree.
Very supportive of Fringe Festivals as much as I can be. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. You are like the busiest guy in theater, probably in Canada.
I'm a little busy. Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And best of luck with everything that's coming up for you in the next little while.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Okay. Take care, Craig. Thanks again.
Okay.
Well, there you go. Me and Chris at the Canadian Stage in Toronto talking about his busy life in theater. Thanks so much, Chris, for making the time. And thank you for taking the time to listen to that. If you like the podcast, please tell all your friends. They can find us on iTunes or the website, theinadequatelife.com. One of the reasons I started this podcast is to remind everybody, myself included, that we all go through ups and downs in pursuit of creative inspiration. And part of living a creative life is taking risks and more often than not, failing. But you have to start over, and you can't let the tough times get you down. So be sure to listen to the good people you've surrounded yourself with, and most importantly, work hard and take care of yourself. Come back another Monday for a brand new episode of The Inadequate Life.